Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. We're broadcasting you live today from Louisville, Kentucky. I had a beautiful drive through the Smoky Mountains this morning. It's just another reminder of the beauty this time of the season. I hope it is a good day where you are. And today we're going to be talking about the article I mentioned yesterday on the air. It's entitled Taking Marriage Private by Stephanie Kuntz. And she is writing in the New York Times, Sunday's edition, suggesting that marriage should be completely privatized as an institution, that we should sever the relationships between marriage and the government and the church and couples who come together. And couples seem to be where she's really focused here, suggesting that any two people should be able to make any kind of formal arrangement for cohabitation and receive the same rights as marriage. She suggests that government should simply get out of the marriage business. She suggests that churches should have the right to recognize whatever marriages they choose to recognize, not to recognize whatever marriages they choose not to recognize, but that the church should not have any say in the definition, nor should the government care. It should simply be up to individuals as a purely privatized institution. We're going to be talking about what that would mean. It is significant that the New York Times ran this as an op-ed piece. It's significant that this argument is being made by someone who in the public square is pretty influential on issues of the family. Stephanie Kuntz is a professor of history at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She is the author of the book Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. We'll be talking about what this means today on the Albert Mohler Program. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation, and we invite you to join the discussion by calling 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll be getting to that issue in just a moment. First, to review some other issues in the news, in the media. Time Magazine's cover story this week is entitled, What Makes Us Good or Evil? Jeffrey Kluger writes, humans are the planet's most noble creatures and its most savage. Science is discovering why. Now, what's really interesting about this is, of course, that the question of morality has to be answered regardless of your worldview. Every single worldview has to give an account for why human beings are moral creatures, why we have a moral sense, why we have what is called the capacity of conscience. From the biblical worldview, this is simply explained very profoundly by the fact that we are made in the image of God, that a part of what it means to be made in the image of God is to be moral creatures. A part of what distinguishes human beings from the rest of the animal kingdom is that we have a moral sense that they do not have, a moral accountability that they do not have. Time Magazine is out with this article suggesting that there is an alternative understanding, an alternative worldview to explain the human moral conscience, the human moral perception, human moral sense of accountability, and that is that offered by evolution and what we might call sociobiology and neurobiology, suggesting that it's simply a process of evolution and the construction of the human brain and the way the human brain works. For instance, in his article, he cites Mark Hauser, professor of psychology at Harvard University, who says that moral judgment is pretty consistent from person to person. Moral behavior, however, is scattered all over the heart. Mr. Hauser is the author of the book Moral Minds, and we've talked about that book on this program because he basically suggests that there's a biological explanation for moral sense, even a biological explanation for why human beings believe that certain actions are moral and other actions are immoral. Now, one of the interesting things I found in this argument is that the sociobiologists, the evolutionary scientists trying to figure out what it would mean to come up with an evolutionary explanation of the human moral sense, they do recognize that there is something of a universality of human moral judgments. I think that's very important. Now, the Christian explanation for that, the biblical explanation, is that every single human being is made in the image of God. And even after the fall, even with that moral sense corrupted by sin, there is still a basic knowledge. In Romans chapter 1, Paul makes this point very, very clearly, saying that there is a law that we do understand, that God has revealed, and even in the conscience, and then in the outer world of nature. The law is also written on the heart. But if you're an evolutionist, and God is out of the picture, and this is a purely natural process that has to be explained, then you have to come up with a hugely, purely, essentially, naturalistic explanation for the moral sense. And you have to explain why certain peoples all around the world seem to have the same kind of moral perception. You also have to explain, and this is what's very difficult, I think, for a lot of people to understand. You have to explain not only why human beings can be good, but why human beings can do awful, evil things. Now, it's very interesting that in one of the the spread pages here in Time magazine, it has a list of what they consider to be the good and the bad. And listed on the good sign are people like Mohandas Gandhi, Mother Teresa, Martin Luther King Jr., and the Dalai Lama. Listed on the bad side of the human ledger are Joseph Stalin, Augusto Pinochet, Adolf Hitler, Osama bin Laden, and Pol Pot. Now, I think there is no doubt that you would much rather have Mother Teresa as a next-door neighbor than Osama bin Laden. But it's really interesting that if your worldview is limited to a purely natural framework, if you are committed to evolution as a worldview, and you have to explain this in purely natural terms, it's very difficult to explain why, if there is no God, it is better to be a Mother Teresa in terms of moral behavior than an Adolf Hitler. And thus, if you look at Time magazine, you're going to see what is more or less the state-of-the-art explanation from the evolutionary worldview. And it is very interesting. One of the things that, by the way, is brought out in this is that from an evolutionary worldview, people tend to act in ways that prioritize the local. In other words, we're more likely to be moved by altruism or empathy for people we see than people we can't see. They explain that's why people will give to local charities more than to needs such as Darfur and Somalia, suggesting that out of sight really does mean out of moral mind. But the other interesting thing about this, when you start thinking about the human species and human moral behavior, is if human beings can do good and human beings can do evil, what do you do in order to encourage more people to do more good and fewer people to do evil, and that people would turn away from these things? If you deny the existence of God as the creator and lawgiver and moral judge, how do you associate moral behavior with public policy? Well, you'll notice when you get to the article, you really don't get an answer. But it'll be very interesting to see where this argument goes from here. I'll tell you, the other side of this that's very interesting is what this would do to the law and to the sense of moral responsibility. How long will it be before some defendant's going to show up in court and say, I didn't do it, my brain did it. It wasn't a matter of moral choice. It wasn't a matter of my decision to do this crime. It was simply a matter of the neurons and chemicals and processes within my brain. We'll be tracking this with you. Other issues to watch. The media is abuzz today about an effort underway in Massachusetts to outlaw spanking or corporal punishment. There is the report in the Boston Herald today that parents who spank their kids, even in their own homes, would be slapped by the long arm of the law under an Arlington nurse's proposal to make Massachusetts the first state in the nation to outlaw corporal punishment. Corporal punishment is already outlawed in nations including Austria, Bulgaria, Croatia, Cyprus, Denmark, Finland, Germany, Greece, Hungary, Iceland, Israel, Latvia, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Portugal, Romania, Sweden, and the Ukraine. All of those nicely in alphabetical order. Sweden became the first country in the world to ban spanking in 1979, and now Massachusetts, at least in one legislative committee, is considering the same. Now, here's my prediction. This won't get very far. I don't think that parents in Massachusetts have to worry that there is legislation right around the corner that's likely to get through the legislative process and outlaw spanking. But here's my warning. If parents are not vigilant about this, then you're going to see parental rights eroded to the point that it will be illegal to parent on biblical terms. And we've got to be very, very clear that we're talking here about corporal punishment. We're talking about spanking. We're not talking about physical abuse and child abuse. We're talking about that which is a chastisement of the child to change behavior and form the character. We're not talking about what is abuse of the child to harm the body. But the failure of many people to make that distinction in the law and in public policy, and what's clearly an effort to redefine parenthood, is underway in the Bay State. Meanwhile, in New York City, the continuing debate in mainline Protestantism over homosexual clergy has taken a new turn. According to the New York Times, the Reverend Katrina D. Foster, who is pastor of the Fordham Evangelical Lutheran Church in the Bronx, is in danger of losing her position simply because she has now declared herself to be in an open lesbian relationship and she and her partner to have a child. Now, I'm putting it in just the framework of the New York Times. That's the way they put it. It's very interesting to see how the New York Times has framed the story. It's a story about a woman who is serving as pastor of a church, and we could talk about that at that level by itself. That would be another program. But here, with a lesbian partner, and is suggesting that she does much good. I want to explain to you something that I find very interesting. Her bishop, the bishop in New York, the Reverend Stephen P. Bauman of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, says that he has taken no action and would take no action against this pastor, quote, because she is someone whose faith is genuine and she lives it out in a very bold and inclusive way. She's not afraid to tell people that she loves God and that God loves them. End quote. Now, what's interesting about that is that we would certainly hope that a pastor would tell people that the pastor loves God and that God loves them, but we would certainly hope that the pastor would go far beyond that to declare what God actually says in His Word about what His expectations are of us, including in the area of sexual behavior and marriage. It's what this bishop doesn't say that essentially says everything. We'll be back to talk about marriage as an institution and Stephanie Kuntz's argument that we need to privatize it. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. We'll be right back. Well, folks, all this can be tracked back to the source, and in this case, the source is Stephanie Kuntz. She is a professor of history at Evergreen State College, that located in Olympia, Washington. Now, what's really interesting is that that college is so liberal, they don't believe in grades. That's the infamous college where I guess everybody's just evaluated. It must be like the University of Lake Wobegon, to take off from Garrison Keillor, where all the children are above average. Evidently, grades are just an oppressive, totalitarian, paternalistic, repressive regime that students shouldn't be accountable to. I'm not sure exactly how that works, but it does tell you a lot about the intellectual context in which this kind of argument is being made. Stephanie Kuntz is in the media a good deal because she's one of those arguing for a revision, in fact, I would say a relativizing of family structure and marriage. And so she's right out there on the liberal cutting edge of a lot of these arguments. If it were limited to Evergreen State College, we wouldn't be having this conversation. It really wouldn't be necessary because it would simply be an isolated academic discussion. But when it hits the op-ed pages of the New York Times and is clearly resonating with where a lot of the intellectual elites are, then it's time for us to talk about it. Her argument is that marriage should be privatized. This is the way she begins it. She says, why do people, gay or straight, need the state's permission to marry? For most of Western history, they didn't because marriage was a private contract between two families. The parents' agreement to the match, not the approval of church or state, was what confirmed its validity. Now, this is one of these interesting arguments from history. And one of the things we need to do in order to be intellectually honest is make certain that the historical point is not only true, as can be proved by the documentation, but has something to do with the topic at hand. Now, when you talk about marriage and its development in Western history, there's no doubt it has been transformed as a legal institution. But what hasn't been transformed, and this is what's so important, what hasn't been changed whatsoever is that the natural family based in natural marriage has been the union of a man and a woman solemnized and recognized as a permanent institution worthy of certain rights and assuming certain responsibilities. That has not changed. Now, has it changed in the law? Of course it has. But one of the interesting things that isn't mentioned in her article is that there is the evolution of law in every area of life. It's not just marriage, it's everything else. If you were to go back and find, you know, arrangements for the sale of, say, real estate or inheritance law or anything like that, you're going to find a lot of that was privatized. But when you have the rise of the nation state and you have the rise of the bureaucratic state and you have the rise of a constitutional republic, the kind of world we know now, then you're going to have laws related to almost every aspect of life. Now, what's really kind of interesting about her article and the fact that the New York Times published it is that her agenda is very clear. And that is to say, the church has its right to say whatever it wants to say about marriage. But the government shouldn't say anything about marriage and should simply let any two people cohabitate and make an arrangement among themselves as they see best. This is what she says as she ends her article. She says, perhaps it's time to revert to a much older marital tradition. Let churches decide which marriages they deem licit, but let couples, gay or straight, decide if they want the legal protections and obligations of a committed relationship. Now, here's why this is so important. It's because I hear people starting to pick up this argument. I'm hearing some people, even some Christians, say, maybe we ought just to surrender marriage as a legal institution. And let's just make sure that in the church we know what marriage is, and we honor marriage as a heterosexual institution, and thus we will recognize only those marriages. But people outside the church should be understood. Well, this is the way you'll often hear it. Lost people are simply going to act like lost people, so let them act like lost people. And so let them create whatever whatever life forms or arrangements they want as couples. Well, here is the limitation with that argument. First of all, it assumes that God has given marriage to Christians. That is a false assumption. Marriage is rooted in creation. It isn't given to the church, it's given to humanity. Marriage is found in Genesis chapter 2, before the fall. Marriage is a part of God's intention as creator from the beginning. It's given to all humanity, and that's why every single civilization in human history has found its way into marriage. Now, do Christians have a special, deeper, more accountable understanding of marriage? Of course we do. It's, of course, made clear to Christians that the church of the Lord Jesus Christ is his purchased possession, is as his bridegroom, as the bride unto Jesus Christ as the bridegroom. So the church is the bride of Christ. We also understand that marriage is a metaphor for Christ's saving work. So, yes, we have a deeper, a more accountable understanding of marriage, but marriage is not limited to Christians. So it is very dangerous for us to buy into the assumption that marriage can be privatized. Let me make a couple of other observations about this. Stephanie Kuntz talks about the fact that she thinks any two people, gay or straight, ought to be able to enter into what she calls the legal protections and obligations of a committed relationship. She, too, is suggesting that society, and inevitably that means the government, has to recognize these committed relationships. So, in other words, she's not really even calling for what she says. She's not really calling for the pure privatization of marriage, because if it were purely private, none of us would know about it. We wouldn't be talking about it. There wouldn't be any special rights or obligations related to any kind of relationship. It would be purely private. But what she really means is just taking away the Christian understanding of marriage, the historic human understanding of marriage as the union of a man and a woman, and instead it can be a man and a man or a woman and a woman. But there's another aspect to this which is very interesting, and that is that she says it's a couple. Well, if it's a purely private arrangement, why need it be limited to two? Why not three or four or eight or 35? You see, this is where the liberals really find themselves, the revisionists. They find themselves in a very awkward position, mostly intellectually dishonest. They're not really talking about privatizing all committed relationships. They're talking about the government decentralizing, revising, reformulating its understanding of marriage so that it's no longer what it always has been, but is now to include same-sex marriage. To join the conversation, I want you to call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Here's the issue. Let's say that your son or daughter comes home from university for Christmas break and says, you know, I think maybe marriage just ought to be completely privatized. Maybe government shouldn't be in the marriage business. Maybe any two people who just want to live together should be able to do that and have all the rights and responsibilities of marriage. How would you respond? Or let's say you find out that your next-door neighbor is saying, you know, we're just going to enter into a committed relationship. Why should marriage matter? What would you say? Do you have anything to say about why marriage would be preferable to any other form of what can be called hooking up? Do you have anything to say about why marriage is the union of a man and a woman and not same-sex marriage, as it's called, or the union of two people of the same gender, and why it's not 3 or 8 or 15 or 35 rather than 2? To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. As I said, if this were an argument that was taking place in some kind of academic colloquium at Evergreen State College, we wouldn't need to talk about it. But when it hits the op-ed pages of the Sunday edition of the New York Times, something is happening. And I think what is happening is that you have a cultural desire on the part of the elites right now, a very ambitious political and cultural desire to see the Christian and the historical understanding of marriage replaced with something that will allow same-sex marriage, but get this, not allow anything and everything. And this is where I think that they're going to find it impossible. Once you say marriage can be something other than the union of a man and a woman, how do you put any limitations on it whatsoever? To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, this is the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back. You know, I really would want to know how you would answer someone who suggests that marriage should be purely a private arrangement. Let me tell you a personal anecdote about this. When I was in college, a couple I knew got involved in a romantic relationship and found themselves having the opportunity to commit fornication. They took the opportunity as young college students, and they were both church-going Christians by their own profession of faith. They knew that premarital sex was wrong, and yet when confronted about it, they declared that they hadn't actually committed premarital sex because they had prayed a prayer of marriage before they committed the act. Now, you know, when you're in college and hear that kind of thing, you got to think fast. You know, is that legitimate or not? And I can remember as we were trying to think about this, gosh, they made a commitment before God. But here's why it falls short of marriage. There was no solemnization of the marriage by anyone who was a witness to it. There was no one who knew that the marriage had taken place, and thus they weren't living as a married couple. They weren't acting as a married couple. If they had broken up, they wouldn't have had to get a divorce. The church, their friends, their families wouldn't have known anything about it had it not come to light in this very strange way. And so in the final analysis, I can remember thinking, you know, that's not marriage. And it was a very early lesson to me, just to remind me that marriage has to be something that is public. It has to be something that is acknowledged, or it really isn't marriage. And, you know, whether you're college students trying to play a moral game in your minds to rationalize your sin, or if you are a same-sex couple determined to have the rights and privileges of marriage, you're basically having to make the same kind of argument, which is that the government must recognize my private decision, or I have the right just to privatize it whatsoever, with or without government sanction. You know, another interesting thing about this is that marriage, of course, is a much sought-after institution. That's why the same-sex marriage impetus is so strong, because it does give a very clear sense of social respect and social recognition. And that's why married couples are accorded that kind of social respect and social recognition. They are Mr. and Mrs. somebody. They are not just two individuals who happen to have the same address. It is recognized in the law. Social Security benefits are defined by marriage. In many states, there are all kinds of benefits that come to persons who are married. And in a medical emergency, a married spouse has the right to make decisions that an unmarried person would not have the right to make. Stephanie Kuntz is one of the most influential revisionists on the issue of marriage. She's writing from what I would define as the far cultural left, teaching at Evergreen State College in Washington. She's arguing in the New York Times that we need to completely privatize marriage as an institution. And in making her case, she suggests that government really got into the marriage business in a big way in the 20th century. She says governments began relying on marriage licenses for a new purpose as a way of distributing resources to dependents. The Social Security Act provided survivors benefits with proof of marriage. Employers used marital status to determine whether they would provide health insurance or pension benefits to employees' dependents. Courts and hospitals required a marriage license before granting couples the privilege of inheriting from each other or receiving medical information. End quote. Well, you know, that is true. That is true. And it's true that she says in the 1950s, using marriage license as a shorthand way to distribute benefits and legal privileges made some sense because almost all adults were married. Cohabitation and single parenthood by choice were very rare. That's true. But the implication, you know where she's headed here, is that that doesn't make any sense anymore. She says, today, however, possession of a marriage license tells us very little about people's interpersonal responsibilities. Half of all Americans aged 25 to 29 are unmarried, and many of them have already incurred obligations as partners, parents, or both. About 40% of America's children are born to unmarried parents. Meanwhile, many legally married people are in remarriages where their obligations are spread among several households. Now, that's true in terms of a state of affairs. But let me ask you this. In any sane way, would the response to that be to privatize marriage? It won't work. You're still going to have some formal way, and this is where I consider her argument to be so intellectually dishonest. You're still going to have some formal way of recognizing that these people belong together. and should be granted the rights and understood to have the responsibilities of marriage and being a family. Some parent is going to be the guardian with legal rights over the children. Unless you just want to turn everything into a commune and enter into something like Plato's Republic, where you eliminate marriage and you eliminate family and just have one society in which you have reproduction and the entire society raising the children, obviously that is not a utopia but a dystopia. And not only that, it obviously won't work. Let's be honest about the marriage issue. Some more thoughts on that in just a moment on the Albert Mueller Program. I really would like to know how you would answer someone who comes home from college on break and says, you know, I'm just not sure marriage needs to be a public institution. Maybe we should just let people do whatever they want to do. They're free moral agents. They're all citizens. Just let them do what they want to do. How would you answer that? How would you answer it coming from your neighbor, from just about anyone out there? Because let me tell you, this is an argument. This is a contention that is making its way through the culture. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I want to go back to Stephanie Kuntz's article from Sunday's edition of the New York Times for just a moment. She says this: using the existence of a marriage license to determine when the state should protect interpersonal relationships is increasingly impractical. Society has already recognized this when it comes to children who can no longer be denied inheritance rights, parental support, or legal standing because their parents are not married. As Nancy Polakoff, an American University law professor, argues, the marriage license no longer draws reasonable dividing lines regarding which adult obligations and rights merit state protection. A woman married to a man for just 9 months gets Social Security survivor benefits when he dies, but a woman living for 19 years with a man to whom she isn't married is left without government support, even if her presence helped him hold down a full-time job and pay Social Security taxes. A newly married wife or husband can take leave from work to care for a spouse or sue for a partner's wrongful death, but unmarried couples typically cannot, no matter how long they have pooled their resources and how faithfully they have kept their commitments, end quote. Well, see, here's the whole point. Let's assume for an argument, for just a moment, that she's right, that that these people can't get these benefits. How would anyone without marriage prove that they actually had these commitments that they supposedly kept? In other words, someone is still going to have to decide who gets the benefits. You can't totally privatize the institution, nor is that actually what she's even calling for. That's just a way of getting to the legalization of same-sex marriage. Let's go to Claire calling from Bowling Green, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Claire.
Hey, Dr. Mueller, thanks for taking my call. I think there's another point at which, is her name Kuntz?
Stephanie Kuntz.
Yeah, she's being intellectually dishonest. Marriage is deeper, broader, older than the state. Anywhere you have society, anywhere people gather, even in tribal communities and, you know, any community at all, they have some kind of understanding that a man and a woman get together for the raising of children. I mean, it's a basic social contract. The state has taken it over and called it marriage and formalized it, but it's so much bigger than any state. You know, nation states are relatively new, but marriage, I mean, you pointed out, goes back to the garden, but you don't have to use the biblical argument. You can look at virtually any society anywhere, and they organize that way for the simple reason that I think if you're going to be intellectually honest, it's because that's the human condition. You need a man and a woman in order to raise children.
Yeah, okay, very good point, Claire, and that's clear intellectual thinking. I mean, actually, you do need a heterosexual couple committed to each other in a formally and socially recognized institution in order to have the procreation and raising of children in a way that serves the cause of society. You do not have to be a Christian to understand that. You're exactly right. You do not have to get to the biblical argument from Genesis 2 in terms of marriage as an institution of creation to get there. And the fundamental point of all of this, and Claire, you're exactly right, is that throughout human history, every single civilization has found its way here. And marriage law has not always been the same, but the understanding of marriage as the union of a man and a woman has been constant throughout this entire process. Now, you can find some isolated examples, but the very fact that they are isolated exceptions makes the rule. And even when you look at something historically like polygamy was still a heterosexual institution, And societies found their way out of polygamy into monogamy simply for the very same reason of seeking social stability. Even if you take the Bible out of the equation, you take the Christian tradition, you take Christian theology out of the equation, you're still left with the universal understanding of marriage. Appreciate that point. I want to go back to Stephanie Kuntz's argument here for just a moment. Again, she's arguing that there's an inequity here. She cites this law professor, Nancy Polakoff, at American University, saying it's not fair that someone married for 9 months gets Social Security survivor benefits, and someone who was faithfully, you know, committed to a person for 19 years without marriage doesn't get the benefit. Well, let me tell you what would make it, you know, fair, and that is if that couple got married, if they were qualified to get married. But you know what she's really getting at here is not so much heterosexual cohabitation. That may be a subtext here. It's really about same-sex marriage, and it's really about same-sex couples. And the implication here is that it's not fair that a heterosexual couple gets these benefits and a homosexual couple does not. Well, again, if you buy into that argument, then why can you stop at homosexual marriage? If any two people can make whatever arrangement they want, then why not three? Why not four? And not only that, why do you have to have it as an enduring relationship established, for instance, in the law? Why not just make it a simple matter of contract? You know, come to think of it, with divorce, that's kind of what we're doing. But as David Blankenhorn says, the last thing you need to do if you are concerned about the perilous state of marriage today is destroy it further by undermining its basic identity by accepting same-sex marriage. And I think that is one of the most compelling arguments that ought to be in play in the public square. Stephanie Kuntz writes, possession of a marriage license is no longer the chief determinant of which obligations a couple must keep, either to their children or to each other. But it still determines which obligations a couple can keep, who gets hospital visitation rights, family leave, health care, and survivor's benefits. This may serve the purpose of some moralists, but it doesn't serve the public interest of helping individuals meet their caregiving commitments. End quote. Now, let's think about that for a moment. Number one, the caregiving commitments are a moral issue. When she says moralists, she really means those who have what she would characterize as a hang-up about sexual morality. But I want to come back to the fact that when you talk about these obligations a couple must keep and the obligations a couple can keep, those are still going to be recognized by someone. They're still going to be recognized eventually by government. The government's going to decide in terms of financial inheritance law. Others are going to decide as insurers on the basis of for insurance, the Social Security Administration, the Veterans Administration. You get on the list. Someone's going to have to recognize which relationships are licit and those that are illicit. You see, Stephanie Kuntz says, let the church worry about the legitimacy of marriage, but the state shouldn't. That's not going to happen. And my guess is she's certainly smart enough to know that isn't going to happen. What she really wants is to make a way for same-sex marriage, or perhaps even for a further broadening of marriage as an institution. But someone's still going to have to decide what marriage is and isn't. And that's why this is such a hot cultural, moral, political, social conversation. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation, and this is the place for us to consider something like this and say, how do we as Christians read an opinion piece like this and figure out what's really going on? Back with more thoughts in just a moment. I'm Albert Miller. Always appreciate hearing from listeners, and I appreciate Albert Manning sending along news. You know, yesterday we were talking about Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm's decision to extend the non-discrimination policies of her state to include transgendered persons. It turns out that on October the 26th of this year, Governor Chet Culver in Iowa had done more or less the same thing. And reading from a statement issued by the governor's office, it mentions that executive order number 4 is intended to achieve and maintain a diverse workforce in state government. This is what it says. Statement from the governor saying, our administration is committed to enhancing diversity through the hiring and promotion practices of state government. It is no secret that there have been some challenges over the past several years related to minority hiring and promoting. We've now spent time identifying the problems. Now it is time for action. For this reason, I've issued an executive order to address this important issue, and I expect all agency directors to follow it, no exceptions. Lieutenant Governor Judge and I have made appointments that are diverse and inclusive, and we expect our agency directors to follow our example. But it is interesting that as you look at this diversity plan, it's going to cover, you know, all of these issues. And it looks like it's one of these that also includes diversity in the state's hiring practices related to sexual orientation and gender identity. And it looks like also this executive order calls upon state agencies to develop a plan for how they're going to do this. This is just another reminder that while we're looking at the whole issue of where the culture's going and where all this is headed, that the people often aren't making decisions through the legislative process about this. It's coming by executive orders. And it's just another reminder to us that many of these cultural changes are being driven by the decisions of courts and by executive orders being handed down by governors and others in official capacities that basically just make it an issue of public policy. I don't know if this particular governor, Chet Colbert, made any mention of this in terms of when he was running for office, if this was his agenda, but it's now, by executive order number 4, the law of the land. Similarly, in Michigan, where Governor Granholm has done more or less the same thing. It's just a reminder to us that when you elect someone to public office, you're electing more than you may bargain for. And as we're thinking about this upcoming election cycle, let's remember that there are a lot of questions that need to be asked, including how a candidate would, if in a capacity to issue such orders, use that power on these issues. I mean, if you're redefining these issues by executive order, you're basically redefining for an entire society, or at least in this case for a state, what it means to consider these issues. When it takes non-discrimination form, you're really talking about making a moral judgment to make no moral judgment. Back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday on the Albert Miller Program. I look forward to that conversation with you, and I'll see you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.